This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
Welcome to our listeners to the Sandwell Talking News, regular ones and new ones. This is the edition due with you on the 30th of May, postal service permitting. And for those who do subscribe to our podcast, it's usually available a day or two earlier than that.
This week, sunrise will be at 4:50. Sunset at 9:25. It will be cooler. By Tuesday, the temperature should reach 19 degrees and there will be patchy rain.
And the cooler weather is certainly very welcome, as certainly a scorcher over the bank holiday. I was unwise enough to be out on the Monday and cut my journey short and came back home as the bus service wasn't up to much. And as I say, welcome to new listeners. I know we've a few because the boom boxes were delivered to them. I don't know who you are, but I do hope you might make yourselves known to us via our talk phone service. You'll hear an announcement about that at the end of this edition, or by email, or phoning the office, or whatever means might suit you. Even carrier pigeon, maybe. I'm not sure. SVI uses a carrier pigeon service. We usually start with SVI's activity schedule for the week ahead, this week being no exception. So here is what's coming up with SVI this coming week.
Hello, SVI members, friends and volunteers. Here's the activities SVI is putting on next week, Monday 1st June. Wonder in Nature, West Methwick Park. 1:30 p.m. This month, Sophie, from Wonder in Nature, will guide you in a gentle and mindful walk around West Smeavik Park. This session will offer a chance to slow down and connect more deeply with nature and each other. Refreshments will be available to buy from the West Smeavik Park Pavilion Cafe. Tuesday, 2nd of June. Gym at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 10 to 12 noon. Break a sweat and boost your energy with fellow SVI members. From treadmills and bikes to weights, there's something for everyone and plenty of support to help you along the way. It's a fun, social way to stay fit and active all year round, rain or shine. Line dancing at Dartmouth Central Club, 1 to 2:30 p.m. Put on your dancing shoes and join Ray and Jean for a lively line dancing session full of fun and feel-good moves. Whether you're looking to stay active, improve your balance, or simply meet new people, this is the perfect chance. Absolute beginners are welcome. Just come along and enjoy. We'd love to see you on the dance floor. Wednesday, 3rd June. Tea and Toast, West Bromwich Town Hall, 10:30 to 12 noon. This month we'll be welcoming our fan from the Let's Talk service at Black Country Healthcare, NHS Foundation Trust. The Let's Talk team supports anyone in the Black Country who may be feeling isolated or lonely, and our fan will be sharing more about the support they offer, as well as some volunteering opportunities for anyone who might like to get involved. It's a relaxed, friendly session, perfect for a chat, a cuppa, and connecting with others. We'd love to see you there. Aquafit, Portway Lifestyle Centre, 1 to 2 p.m. Get summer body ready. This gentle toning activity in the water is suitable for everyone, with expert instructor Alison. Contact SVI if you are interested. Thursday, 4th of June. Showdown, Portway Lifestyle Centre, 2 to 4 p.m. Come and join us for this fast-moving, interactive sport that's a mix of table tennis and air hockey. It's specially designed for blind and visually impaired players. But the best part is anyone can play and everyone has fun. Expect laughter, friendly competition, and a chance to try something a little different. Why not come along and see what it's all about? It is important that you contact the office either by phone, message, Facebook or email to let us know that you are attending any of our events. That's all for this week. We look forward to seeing you soon. The SVI team, Sandwell Visually Impaired, West Bromwich Town Hall, Lodge Road, West Bromwich, B708AY. Phone 01215254810. Website sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk.
And I'll repeat that number. It's 01215254810. I'm afraid these artificial voices I use don't always get the pauses and timing right between words, but I keep working on it. But we do use those voices because it's quicker and easier for me to insert that information in that way. And the SVI activities are certainly worth joining in with. I was on the one last Thursday where we went to the old lockup in Stillhouse Lane, which is now a police museum, and I hope to squeeze a bit about that into next week's Talking News. On to this week and some of the headlines coming up in this week's edition.
Some pieces from the week's readings from the Express and Star. Wednesday the 20th of May, news. Crime fighting initiative gets cash boost. Boy 16 arrested for screwdriver possession. Brewing up a storm in a teacup. Driver jailed for killing a father. The Scots Arms area cherished by locals. Thursday, four dogs stolen every day. Man jailed for stabbing outside pizza takeaway. A car left abandoned for weeks. Former police station to become flats. Baggies hot prospects signs contract. Saturday. Baggies hoping to reset EFL relationship. Bitter blow to nation's favourite brew. Eshelth trusts pay out millions in damages. Teen dies after e-bike collision. When the pavement's too hot for your dog. Monday. Abastos fear while fighting blaze. Trio found guilty of drugs dealing. Hand broken tackling shoplifting. Knife recovered. Music festival on the move. Tuesday. New Natanal forest could be planted in the Midlands. Albion hopes Mossa will help young talent to thrive. Opening day for new Bake My Day shop. Four arrested as nitrous oxide boxes found at shop. Police get e-bikes to tackle antisocial behaviour.
Those were the headlines we covered from stories taken with kind permission from the Express and Star from the 20th of May up until Tuesday the 26th. I'm afraid that the nature of what we do means we always are a bit behind the latest day's news. But something that's come in just now, a bit later, was the announcement via a press release from Sandwell Council about the makeup of the new council.
New leader and cabinet for Sandwell Council. Councillor Ray Nock has been formally confirmed as the new leader of the council at Sandwell's annual meeting. Leader of the council, Councillor Ray Nock, said, "I was born in Sandwell and have lived and worked here all my life. So it is an honour and a privilege to be elected as the new leader of Sandwell Council. There is a lot to be proud of in Sandwell, and alongside my new cabinet, we are totally committed to making our borough an even better place to live and work. We are going to work hard for all our residents and to bring our community together. We will be focused on the issues that matter to people in Sandwell, creating jobs, boosting our town centres and high streets, and helping with the cost of living." The meeting, which was held yesterday, 26th May, also saw Councillor Gary Dale appointed as the council's deputy leader. Councillor Nock has also selected the council's new cabinet, which is responsible for setting the strategic and policy direction of the council. Councillor Ray Nock, leader of the council and cabinet member for regeneration and economic growth. Councillor Gary Dale, statutory, deputy leader and cabinet member for finance and corporate services. Councillor Ken Parsons, deputy leader and cabinet member for housing. Councillor Bob Jones, cabinet member for environment and enforcement. Councillor Mona Karana, cabinet member for children and families. Councillor Jack Sabharwal, cabinet member for education and skills. Councillor Richie Massey, Cabinet Member for Adult Services, Health and Wellbeing. Councillor Mike Cooper, Cabinet Member for Customer Services and Neighbourhoods.
Hi everyone, it's Mia. Just reading some newspaper articles from The Express and Star, dated Wednesday, the 20th of May. I hope you're all enjoying your week, and I sure am looking forward to the lovely weather that we've got ahead of us. It feels like a lovely early start to the summer. Let's begin. Cash fighting initiatives get boost in £1.4 million cash injection. More than £1 million is to be pumped into West Midlands projects to tackle a range of issues, including domestic abuse and modern slavery. West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster announced £1.4 million will be allocated to 66 schemes delivered through community safety partnerships across Dudley, Sandwell, Walsall, Wolverhampton, Birmingham, Coventry and Solihull. Mr. Foster said the investment was aimed at tackling crime, disorder, antisocial behaviour and reoffending. Sandwell will receive £153,000, including £55,000, for a dedicated antisocial behaviour officer and a range of mentoring programmes designed to steer young people away from crime and exploitation. Wolverhampton's £139,362,000 allocation includes significant investment in youth violence prevention, community cohesion and antisocial behaviour initiatives, alongside continued support for domestic homicide reviews. Across Dudley, Walsall and Solihull, funding will support a diverse range of programmes, from youth justice, mentoring, neighbourhood safety initiatives and targeted interventions addressing vulnerability and exploitation. Birmingham will receive more than £613,000 supporting 9 key initiatives, while in Coventry, more than £153,000 will fund community-led initiatives. Mr. Foster said, "This £1.4 million investment is about delivering real, tangible action and outcomes, supporting projects that prevent and tackle crime and antisocial behaviour and reduce reoffending across the West Midlands." Boy 16 arrested as a screwdriver was found. A teenager was arrested while police was patrolling Victoria Park in Smethwick. The boy, aged 16, was stopped and searched, and a large screwdriver was recovered, along with a quantity of cannabis. He was arrested on suspicion of possession of an offensive weapon and possession of drugs with intent to supply. Brewing up a storm in a teacup. There is nothing more British than a cup of tea. But if someone else is making it, we would rather they didn't bother. Here are some key statistics related to drinking tea. 42% of Brits have refused a cup of tea made by someone else. Here are a couple of Britain's biggest tea turn-offs. Number one being too much milk, with 29% of people voting that as a turn-off. Number two, weak tea, with 28%. And number three, reused tea bags, with 24%. Number four is cold tea, rated at 21%. And number five is overly strong tea, rated 18%. 85% of people claim they make the perfect cup every time, but many admit to tea sins. 57% of people press the tea bag against the mug. 27% of people add milk before removing the tea bag. 14% of people reboil the same water throughout the day. 1 in 10 Brits don't let their tea brew long enough. Here's another poll just saying who makes the worst tea. 29% is voted for friends, 24% for work colleagues, 23% siblings, 17%, which is quite bizarre, is complete strangers, and with 8% is bosses. And then this is just a statistic related to gender, so 45% of women versus 38% of women have turned down a cup of tea. Very interesting. And at the bottom, there is just a QR code to scan for some top tips on how to make the perfect brew. Driver is jailed for killing father, 54, in hit and run. A Black Country man has been jailed for more than a decade after hitting husband and wife with his car, killing the man and seriously injuring the woman in Birmingham. Harren Duppel Othwell of Sorrel Close, Tivdale, was driving a Vauxhall Corsa on December 16th last year along Soho Road in Birmingham, West Midlands, police said. The victims, a man aged 54 and woman aged 47, were walking along the pavement hand in hand, going about their day just after 11:15 a.m. Othwell, 41, was driving away from the city centre on the opposite side of the road with the couple facing his moving car. But for reasons still unknown, the car then swerved into oncoming traffic and mounted the pavement, hitting the two victims. The vehicle showed no signs of braking until it finally came to a stop as it collided with another parked car. CCTV footage then showed Othwell reversing away from the injured man before placing the car back into forward drive, hitting the man again, and driving away. Sadly, the man died at the scene from his injuries. His wife was taken to hospital and suffered life-changing injuries. A thorough and detailed investigation then ensued as officers began to trace the car and the driver. Othwell was arrested less than 24 hours later, claiming he was unaware anyone had died. He appeared at Birmingham Crown Court on May 13th, having pleaded guilty to causing death by dangerous driving, causing serious injury by dangerous driving, causing death by driving whilst disqualified, causing death by driving without a licence and insurance, failing to stop and being a driver of a vehicle involved in a road accident, and failing to report. Othwell was jailed for 11 years and 3 months. He was also disqualified from driving for 20 years and must pass an extended retest to obtain a licence. In a statement from his wife, she said, "I cry every day for my husband. He was my emotional support and my strength. He managed our finances, made important decisions, and kept our family stable. Without him, I feel completely lost. The driver's actions have taken my husband from me, destroyed my health, and shattered my children's lives. Because of him, I have lost my partner, my independence, my strength, and my future as I knew it." Detective Sergeant Julie Lyman from the Serious Collision Investigation Unit said, "This was a tragic incident that has left a family without their father and loved one. Our thoughts remain with all his family and his wife, who is still suffering with injuries that will affect her for the rest of her life. Othwell's actions in driving away and refusing to help and report the incident were cruel and heartless, and showed his complete disregard for what he had done in killing and seriously injuring innocent people. No sentence will ever bring back the family's loved one, but I hope it brings them some peace that Othwell will now serve time behind bars." Locals cherish area for community spirit and its convenient location. We visited a vibrant area of Sandwell's border with Birmingham that is cherished for its community spirit, local parks, and convenient location. We began by the Scott Arms, regarded by many as Great Barr's main attraction. Although the area has undergone significant change over the years, the Scott Arms, which is almost 200 years old, is still a staple for both current and former Great Barr locals. Many people we came across said this historic building is the suburb's most recognisable building. Nigel Walker from G. Gibbs Funeral Directors, who has lived in the Great Barr for 3 years, told us he appreciated the area's pub life. He said, "I think pub life is pretty good." Another aspect Nigel enjoyed was the area's community feel, which is important in his line of work in the funeral industry. "Everyone seems to know everyone," he said. "Everyone seems to get on. We've built a lot of rapport with a lot of families, so we do know a lot of people there." Nigel also praised the neighbourhood for being in a convenient location with a wide variation of shops, as well as Great Barr being pretty easy to get to. Great Barr straddles Birmingham and Black Country areas. For Nigel, he considers Great Barr to be part of Birmingham. Pointing to Walsall Road, Nigel said he would definitely consider it to be part of Birmingham. "I think with this particular road here, It's a cross junction to town. It's a cross junction to other parts of Birmingham. Kimberly Buddle has lived in Great Barr for 43 years. During that time, Kimberly says Great Barr has changed, while the Scott Arms has remained a permanent fixture. She said, "It's just different shops, different owners. The area has changed." Kimberly shared she loved her neighbours, adding, "I love the people we seem to stick together. It's a community." Anthony Willoughby has worked at Sue Ryder in Great Barr for 7.5 years. He loves the area's community spirit. He said, "I didn't realise when I first started, but having been here for 7.5 years, I've realised that there is a huge community spirit in Great Barr. Lovely and diverse. All cultures. Everyone just coming together. It's a lovely place to work." When asked if he felt that people should visit Great Barr more, he said, "Definitely. Visit the shop as well, get some bargains, and support the Sue Ryder." Looking around Sue Ryder, there's plenty of furniture, electricals, and even designer clothing items. Anthony says you can find anything that you can possibly imagine. He recommends the Greggs in Great Barr, where there's a large seating area, and people go there to chat. Chloe Burton, who works at Spa Lala next to Coco Latte, said that she had loved living in the neighbourhood for her entire life and praised the area for being a great place for families to reside. She said, "I've lived around Great Barr all my life. I just love that everybody is so friendly, so helpful. As a community, we do stuff together. Through COVID time, everybody helped each other and mucked in." Chloe said the area was an ideal location for families. She said, "For families, there's quite a lot around here. You've got the park, you've got local shops, you've got little walks to go on. You've even got Aldi. I love it. There's not many shops left now, but the bits that are around here are good. Handy if you need a quick something from Poundland, you can nip in," she added. "For families, there's quite a lot around here. You've got the park, you've got local shops, you've got little walks to go on. You've got Aldi. I love it all." A local highlight in the area for Chloe is Red House Park, a 27-acre park known for its scenic green space and play area for children. Chloe said it was a popular place for her young family. "I have a little boy who is 6 and he loves Red House Park," she said. "We go on adventures looking for bugs. He just loves it. Climbing frames, the areas around here, the children's play area. He loves it." If you would like us to highlight your neighbourhood, please contact daniel.stacey@jpress.co.uk.
Hello, it's Jan Lloyd reading articles from the Express and Star on the 21st of May. 4 dogs stolen every day in the UK, police figures suggest. French bulldogs are the most stolen breed in the UK, but overall dog thefts are down by 11%. An article by Josie Clark. An average of 4 dogs were stolen every day across the UK last year, latest police figures suggest. The figure brings the total number of reported dog thefts to around 25,000 over the past 11 years, with breeds such as French Bulldogs, Staffordshire Bull Terriers and Dachshunds most at risk, analysis of police data by Direct Line found. However, improved awareness and the introduction of the Pet Abduction Act in May 2024, which made pet theft a specific criminal offence in England and Northern Ireland, might have contributed to the 11% decline in thefts compared with the previous year, the insurer said. French Bulldogs remain the most stolen breed, but thefts of Staffordshire Bull Terriers, German Shepherds and Dachshunds rose. Despite ranking 8th overall, Cocker Spaniels recorded the fastest growth in reported thefts compared with the previous year. An estimated 344 stolen dogs were reunited with their owners, a recovery rate of 21% in line with previous years. Half of the dog owners, 50%, worry about their pet being stolen, with 33% saying they only ever walk their dog on a lead, and 26% supervising their dog while it is in the garden, a survey for a Direct Line suggests. Some 18% have installed motion-activated or security cameras to ward off thieves, while 17% use a tracking device to monitor their dog's location. Adam Bergin, head of trading and customer at Direct Line, said, "Any reduction in dog theft is welcome, but it's important not to confuse lower numbers with lower risk. More than four dogs a day were still stolen in 2025, and it's clear the issue has not gone away. While it's encouraging to see more dogs reunited with their families, the reality is that most stolen dogs still do not come home. Man jailed after stabbing outside pizza takeaway. A 21-year-old man has been jailed after a violent disorder outside a takeaway left another man with multiple stab wounds. Zafran Sajjad pleaded guilty to grievous bodily harm at a hearing at Wolverhampton Crown Court in February. The court heard how the incident unfolded on December 19, 2023, outside a takeaway pizza shop in Marketplace, Wensbury. A group of friends were walking past the shop when they were confronted by Sajjad and three others in what police described as a brutal, unprovoked attack. One of the victims was stabbed multiple times before managing to escape and call for emergency assistance. Sajjad and the others then fled in a car. Detectives traced the vehicle driven by Sajjad after discovering it was advertised for sale at his workplace. When questioned by officers, Sajjad initially claimed he could not remember being at the scene. He later changed his account, telling the police he had attempted to calm the situation down. However, investigators uncovered a £26 transaction from the takeaway on Sajjad's bank statement from the night of the attack, while CCTV footage also placed him at the scene. Sajjad, of Reedswood Lane, Warsaw, has admitted grievous bodily harm and has been jailed for 5 years and 3 months. Car left abandoned on petrol station forecourt for weeks by Kirsty Louise Card. An abandoned vehicle has been left at a petrol station near the M6 for weeks. Residents spotted a notice on the discarded grey Renault Clio at the Esso garage on Birmingham Road, Great Bar, before the local elections at the start of the month. The notice states that the vehicle would be destroyed if not removed within 2 weeks. However, it remains at the site. A 29-year-old resident who declined to give his name said, "I don't know when it was left there, as I only noticed it was abandoned when the notice was on it, but it's been there for weeks. I pass it almost every day." The notice said that it would be removed after 2 weeks, but it's definitely been longer than that. Well over a month, I'd say. The notice has been issued by Euro Car Parks Limited, which has been contacted for comment. The notice attached to the front and back of the vehicle reads, "Please note that this vehicle has been left on this site with neither leave nor licence of the landowner, the managing agent or tenant. You are hereby given notice that this vehicle will be removed from its location on --2026 unless it's permanently removed from this site." The Express and Star checked the vehicle registration via government website and found that the vehicle is fully taxed, but its MOT expired in January. The website isitnicked.com states there is no record of it being recorded as stolen on the police national computer. West Midlands Police have been contacted to verify. A Sandwell Council spokesman said, "The council takes the abandonment of vehicles very seriously, and we regularly work with police to remove such vehicles from public land." And there's a photograph of the car positioned just away from the petrol pumps at the station, with the Lundy's shop that's part of the station in the background. And you can see the notice on the back, although it's you can't read it from the photograph. Looks a very nice, fairly new car. Seems very strange for it to have been abandoned for so long. Former police station set to become flats as plans approved. A former police station will be converted into flats after planning approval was granted. The former Aldbury police station will be converted into 6 flats after Sandwell Council granted permission. The building in the town centre's Stone Street off Aldbury Ringway was emptied by West Midlands Police as part of cost-cutting closures at the start of the decade. The planning application by BSSO Properties said much of the site would remain untouched, including fences and the former station car park, and the building's former police offices would be converted into a mix of 6 1- to 3-bedroom flats. A statement included with the application said, "The proposal involves the internal conversion of the existing building to create 6 self-contained flats. The development will retain the existing building footprint, scale, massing and roof form, ensuring that the external appearance of the building remains largely unchanged. The proposed conversion of the former Aldbury police station to 6 self-contained flats represents a high-quality, sustainable and policy-compliant development. The scheme reuses a vacant building, preserves local character, develops compliant residential accommodation and supports Sandwell housing and regeneration objectives. Sandwell Council also plans to buy the former Smethwick Police Station in Piddock Road to refurbish and convert the building into around 30 one- and two-bedroom flats. Baggy's Hot Prospect signs his first pro contract. One of Albion's hottest young prospects has been rewarded with his first professional contract following an impressive breakthrough campaign. Teenager Ramar McNeil, who joined Albion at a young age following a trial with Villa, has risen up the ranks in the club's academy. At the age of just 16, he has made his way to the Albion's PL2 side this season and has made big impact. Across the course of the campaign, he netted 3 times and picked up 3 assists in 11 appearances, putting in some eye-catching performances. McNeil, now 17, set up 2 goals on his first start for the under-21 side against Liverpool and netted a brace in a 4-2 victory over Derby County. The Dudley-born winger, who joined the club at the age of 7, has been rewarded with his first professional deal, a 2-year contract running until the summer of 2028. Albion Academy manager Richard Stevens said it is a reward for the level of quality he has shown this season. The academy boss also insists that McNeil will only continue to get better at the club. He said, "When you look at Ramar's season, it's only right to reward that level of quality with this contract. He's been in the academy from a very early age and has been a really eye-catching player during my time at the club. He's had some hurdles and some really good challenges along the way, but he's overcome them during his academy journey, and that's allowed him to grasp these opportunities in the under-21s. It showed, too, as he stayed in the team and didn't come out of it. That testimony to the effort he's put in, because he's a very humble lad and has always supported the boys, even when out injured. Ramar was always there, home and away, backing the rest of his teammates. We set out to offer these lads early professional contracts and early exposure to those higher age groups. In finding those experiences, the lads have shown a togetherness, spirit and a culture to go and get some really impressive wins with their age groups. He has the chance to grow a really nice career at Albion, and I only see Ramar flourishing in this environment and getting better with time." And there's a photograph of Ramar McNeil when he was 16. Looks as though he's ready to race across the pitch. He's in his Albion kit, his arm splayed out and his legs bent, ready to go.
Hello, this is Rachel, and I've got some recordings for you from the 22nd of May. Attack on three-legged dog in park raised by MP in Commons. An MP has raised the plight of a three-legged dog which was savagely mauled to death in a park. Addressing the House of Commons, West Bromwich MP Sarah Coombs called for a parliamentary debate on how to deal with the owners of dangerous dogs. Otis, a 12-year-old rescue dog, was attacked by 2 Rottweilers in a park off Tombstone Road, West Bromwich, on April 23rd. Miss Coombs said, "Can we please have a debate to talk about the owners of dangerous dogs and who will pay when one dog attacks another?" Leader of the House, Sir Alan Campbell, said the Dangerous Dogs Act 1991 provided powers to protect the public, adding the Dangerous Dogs Task Force had been commissioned to look at further measures. Driver flees from scene after crash. Police launch appeal for witnesses to two-car collision by Dan Stacey. A driver fled the scene after a 2-car crash in the Black Country, which left 2 men with potentially serious injuries. Emergency services were called to Princess Grove, West Bromwich, on Wednesday night, following reports of a crash involving 2 vehicles. According to West Midlands Police, the woman driving one of the cars was uninjured, while the driver of the 2nd vehicle left the scene before officers arrived. Police are appealing for witnesses or anyone with information to get in touch. A spokeswoman for the force said officers were called to Princess Grove, West Bromwich at 8 p.m. to reports of a collision involving 2 cars. A woman who was driving one of the vehicles was not injured, but the driver of the other vehicle fled the scene. An investigation is underway to trace them. Anyone with any information is asked to call us on 101 or use the live chat option on our website, quoting incident number 5192 of May 20th. A spokesman for West Midlands Ambulance Service said, "We were called at around 8 p.m. to a road traffic collision involving two cars on Princess Grove in West Bromwich. Two ambulances attended the scene. Upon arrival, we found three patients. The first and second two men, who were passengers, were assessed and had sustained potentially serious injuries. They received treatment at the scene before being conveyed to Midland Metropolitan University Hospital for further assessment. The third was a woman who was the driver. She was assessed and had sustained injuries not believed to be serious. She received self-care advice from ambulance staff before being discharged at the scene," said the ambulance service spokesman. "Anyone with information has been urged to contact West Midlands Police on 101 or use the live chat services via the West Midlands Police website, quoting incident number 5192 of May 20th. Regulator fails to improve Royal Mail performance, by Alan Jones. The postal regulator has been accused of failing to change Royal Mail's unacceptable performance. A report by MPs said there were fears that Ofcom was not up to the job of regulating a postal market that is growing in competition and complexity. The Business and Trade Committee said that despite incurring Ofcom fines every year since 2022, Royal Mail continued to fail to meet both the public's expectations and its own regulated targets. The MP said Ofcom has 6 months to prove it has the power and drive to regulate the 21st century postal market. Their report said letter volumes have dropped dramatically and parcel competitors like Amazon are able to hive off profits using the Universal Postal Service, delivering parcels to harder to reach addresses without contributing to the cost of the Royal Mail infrastructure that serves them. Between April 2025 to January 2026, 74.9% of first-class mail was delivered the next day, 18.1 percentage points below the target, which the committee said translates into around 126 million first-class letters arriving late over the year. This means that hospital appointments were missed and benefit decision notices delayed, says the MPs. Along with the article is a photograph with the caption, "The modern postbox, but the Royal Mail is still struggling to improve its performance despite pressure," and shows a person posting a parcel into a Royal Mail parcel box. Younger people more sick than previous generations. Study finds the issues were most stark when it comes to obesity and mental health, by Jane Kirby. The UK is experiencing a generational health drift, with younger people suffering poor health earlier than in previous generations, researchers say. A study of more than 88,500 people born since 1946 found the issues were most stark when it comes to obesity and mental health. For the new study, experts from University College London, UCL, King's College London, and the University of Oxford examined changes in physical and mental health across the generations born between 1946 and 2000 to 2002. They looked in detail at the health conditions people had and at what age, and compared those with other generations. The researchers found little suggestion of improvements in health for people born since 1946, which they said had implications for people working and supporting the economy. For several outcomes, particularly obesity, mental ill health and diabetes, prevalence of poor health was higher in more recent generations. The team said long-term declines in mortality and fertility mean that by 2050, one quarter of the British population will be aged 65 and over, with considerable implications for future demand for health and social care and also for the economy. The findings, published in the journal Population Studies, included data from 51 studies published up to June 2024. The team warned that the higher prevalence of ill health in more recent generations suggests that more years in total may be spent living in poor health than experienced by previous generations. They concluded, while several mechanisms could explain the generational health drift, evidence from British birth cohorts suggests that more recent cohorts are experiencing an earlier onset of poor health for several outcomes.
Hello everyone, this is Linda, reading from Saturday, the 23rd of May's Express and Star. Baggies are hoping to reset EFL relationship this summer. Albion will look to reset relations with the English Football League this summer after the recent profit and sustainability breach hearing. Baggies Chiefs met with the club's Fan Advisory Board, FAB, a group of 10 elected supporter representatives for the third time at the end of its first season. Representing the club were Executive Director Mark Miles, Bill Cull's Chief Marketing Officer Ashish Patel and new Chief Business Officer Sam Jeffrey, among other directors. Six members of Albion's FAB were present for the meeting, including Vice Chair Richard Jefferson, and the club were pressed on issues involving the finance breach in late March. The board pushed for answers on the club's decision not to appeal Albion's two-point penalty, to which Miles reiterated that an appeal would have no supporting merit or bearing on Albion's outcome and would come at a significant cost of time and resources. It was raised as to whether Albion's strong statements could damage relationships with the EFL, to which Miles revealed the club intended to meet with the governing body to reset relations this summer. Albion recently voted in favour of a new squad cost ratio to govern the division's finance, and the notion was passed for 2026-27 with support of 20 of 24 clubs. The system allows clubs to spend 85% of revenue brought in, as well as a cash injection of £33 million by owners rolling across the three seasons, capped at £15 million per season. Miles revealed the Baggies had used a shadow SCR in the 2025-26 season to help with the transition to the new model. The club's new business chief, Jeffrey, appointed from Norwich in March 2026, explained how the club aimed to deliver high-impact commercial projects capable of lifting revenues to help on-field results under the new squad cost ratio. Albion's FAB assessed their first season since its launch last autumn and pointed to successes, including the push for free coaches for the 7,000-strong away following at Blackburn in April, and the application of loyalty points for ticket sales at Oxford in early March. Reflecting on a hugely disappointing season, Miles once again branded the campaign unacceptable. The FAB quiz club bosses on poor decisions regarding head coach appointments and transfers. Miles admitted there was an over-reliance on a data approach installed by former club president Andrew Nesta, and that recruitment would now fall under a game model devised by Dominic Price, who moved to the Hawthorns this year as technical director. Bitter blow to nation's favourite brew. The familiar taste of tea is under threat from climate change, which could deliver a more bitter flavour to the nation's copper, campaigners say. A report published by aid agency Christian Aid warns that rising temperatures and worsening weather extremes in Kenya, India and Sri Lanka could make tea more bitter. Tea growers in the UK are experiencing climate change, and they too warn it is making it harder to achieve consistent flavours. Disruptions to harvest caused by the changing climate are likely to cause price spikes, rising costs and unreliable supplies of the staple British brew. Christian Aid also says the biggest impact is on smallholding farmers and tea producers, who are also being hit by the rising price of fertiliser and fuel as a result of the war in Iran. The charity is calling for action to support farmers, including developing more resilient tea plants, improving irrigation and planting shade trees to protect the bushes, as well as fair pricing, funding for producers to put in measures to help them adapt to climate change and protections for workers. The report warns that tea production relies on stable temperature and rainfall conditions, which are now shifting in producer nations, with optimal growth within a relatively narrow temperature range of between 13 degrees C and 30 degrees C, and with adequate but not excessive rainfall. Dr. Nir Mittal, Senior Climate Services Scientist at the Met Offices and visiting scientists at the University of Leeds, said, "Tea brands depend on delivering a stable and recognisable flavour profile. As climate variability increases, achieving that consistency becomes more challenging. Tea flavours and quality depend on a balance of compounds such as catechins, amino acids and polyphenols, according to the report. But higher temperatures increase the production of more astringent compounds while reducing sweetness, leading to a more bitter taste. Erratic rainfall can dilute compounds that give tea its depth and character, while extreme weather from droughts to floods and worsening crop pests in warmer conditions can also put pressure on the plants, leading to lower yields, lower quality and more bitter crops," the report says. "The result is a simple but unsettling prospect. The familiar taste of the British copper, smooth, balanced, reliable, is becoming harder to guarantee," it warns. Claire Nasike-Akello, Climate Adaptation and Resilience Lead at ChristianAid, said, "For generations, consumers have taken for granted that a cup of tea will taste the same day in, day out. But that consistency depends on a stable climate, and that stability is now breaking down. We are seeing the beginning of a shift towards a harsher brew, with the risk that Britain's favourite drink becomes more bitter, more expensive and less reliable." Health trusts pay out millions in damages. Health trusts in the West Midlands have paid out more than £5.6 million in damages to staff in the last 5 years, new figures show. University Hospitals Birmingham shelled out the largest sum in the region and the second highest across England, with a massive payout of £2,570,672 in damages to its workers. The trust also received the nation's highest volume of claims over the five-year period, with 210 received overall for staff workplace injuries. The figures were obtained via Freedom of Information requests to NHS Resolution and cover a five-year period up to April 2026. Of the region's other NHS trusts, Birmingham Community Healthcare's total payout came to £664,227 over the same time frame, after 31 claims were submitted to the trust, and Sandwell and West Midland Birmingham hospitals paid £530,462, with 114 claims received. Walsall Healthcare NHS Trust paid £465,586, having received 67 claims, and the Royal Wolverhampton handed out £448,769 to claimants from a five-year total of 103 claims. The West Midlands Ambulance Service, which covers the whole region from Staffordshire to Warwickshire, paid out £1,887,996 to injured paramedics and staff from 93 claims across the 5 years. Teen dies after e-bike collision. A police investigation is underway following a tragic collision in the Black Country that left an 18-year-old man dead and another teenager injured. Officers from West Midlands Police were called to Bilston High Street shortly before 9:40 p.m. on Thursday after reports that an e-bike had struck a Pelican Crossing pole. Emergency services attended the scene and an 18-year-old male was taken to hospital with serious injuries. Despite medical efforts, he later died. "Our thoughts are with his loved ones at this devastating time," said West Midlands Police. A 14-year-old boy was also involved in the incident and sustained injuries which are not believed to be serious. The Force's Serious Collision Investigation Unit is now working to establish the full circumstances surrounding the collision. Officers have confirmed that the bike involved was no longer at the scene when they arrived, and they are seeking to locate it as part of their inquiries. Investigators are currently reviewing CCTV footage from the surrounding area and are urging members of the public to come forward if they have any relevant information. They are particularly interested in hearing from anyone who was in the area at the time. Anyone with information is asked to contact police via live chat on the West Midlands Police website or call 101, quoting log 5921 of the 21st of May 26. West Midlands Ambulance Service sent two ambulances, two paramedic officers and a Merritt trauma doctor with critical care paramedics to the scene. A spokeswoman said that on arrival, crews found an e-bike with two passengers had come off the road. If the pavement's too hot to handle, it's too hot for your dog. Vets have warned pet owners to watch their animals for signs of overeating and make sure they stay hydrated by leaving plenty of water out. With the Met Office forecasting temperatures of above 25 degrees C this weekend and into next week, the UK is bracing for an intense heatwave that will put both people and pets to the test. A spokesperson for veterinary care provider Medivet and Partners said, as pets are unable to communicate when they are overheating or struggling with dehydration, they are at risk of suffering in extreme conditions more than most. Pets suffering a heat stroke may display symptoms such as excessive panting or thirst, very red gums, lethargy and vomiting and diarrhoea. Pet owners should react by soaking their pet with cool water or even non-toxic fluids such as cold fizzy drink if water is not available, then contact their vet for advice. Dog owners have also been advised to restrict their walking routine to cooler times of the day and to avoid going out during the hottest times of the day. On extremely hot days, dogs will benefit from skipping a walk completely, as evenings and early mornings are still hot enough to trigger heatstroke. Dr. Rhianne Littlehales, Clinical Governance Director at Medivet and Partners, said, if you're not sure if the pavements are too hot, place the back of your hand on the ground for 7 seconds. If you struggle to hold it down, it's too hot to walk your dog, and you should hold off until the sun has gone down.
This is Alison, reading a selection of articles from the Express and Star, dated Monday, the 25th of May. Asbestos fears as firefighters battle blaze at plastics factory. 50 firefighters tackled a major blaze which broke out in the Black Country. Crews used 11 fire appliances and two hydraulic platforms to tackle the inferno on Rood End Lane in Oldbury in the early hours of Saturday. By 5 p.m, fire crews largely brought the blaze under control, almost 12 hours after being called. West Midlands Fire Service later reported its main response had been concluded. It said when crews arrived, they found that 85% of the building was involved in the fire, and that they tackled the fire in some challenging weather conditions using specialist equipment. The fire broke out at Total Plastics on Rood End Road Industrial Estate, and that building is deemed to be structurally unsafe to enter, though the fire service said that they've made good progress on scene and have brought the fire under control. Rood End Road in Oldbury was closed for much of the day. Sandwell Council said in a statement that the premises may have had an asbestos cement roof. Residents, who were advised to keep their windows closed at the height of the blaze, expressed their shock at the fire and worries over the impact on health. One householder, Ranesh Bhutta, said he woke up early due to the commotion caused by the fire incident. He said, I was woken up at about 10 to 5 with loud noises. It was just popping off everywhere. I looked out the window and it was just a massive fire. I was extremely worried. I didn't know what it was, whether it was a house or whether it was a factory. Out of our window, we couldn't really tell. Ranesh said there was a fire in the area previously, but not to this scale. He said there was a major fire in the industrial estate a couple of years ago. Nothing as close to home as this. We've had all the windows closed. I'm finding it difficult to breathe now, if I'm honest. An investigation into the cause is now underway, although officials say it is still too early to determine how the blaze started. Sandwell Council assured residents that health risks from asbestos debris were low, but advised on safe handling and disposal methods. The council said it was possible some of these materials may have been released in the smoke plume and deposited in ash and debris on a section of Pell Crescent. However, the UK Health Security Agency advises that the health risk is low because asbestos fibres are usually trapped within the material and are not easily released into the air. Sandwell Council will be assessing the situation and arranging for decontamination of the area. Trio are found guilty of drug dealing activity. Three men have been found guilty of supplying crack cocaine and heroin in the Sandwell area by majority verdicts. Adam Liaquat, 19, Asad Khan, 23, of West Bromwich, and Yakuba Sawane, 19, who has links to Erdington, were all convicted by a jury following a trial at Wolverhampton Crown Court for a string of offences relating to a supply ring that was operating in the borough. All three were arrested after crack cocaine and heroin wraps with an estimated street value of more than £3,000 were seized by West Midlands Police during an operation last year. The jury heard that officers searched an area in Beaches Road, Oldbury, on December 12th and recovered 111 heroin wraps worth £1,110 and 109 crack cocaine wraps worth £1,090. The following day, a search of a silver-coloured Honda linked to the group uncovered 114 crack cocaine cigarettes worth £1,140. A red Mitsubishi stolen in Newhall Road, Rowley Regis, in November 2023 and recovered in Perry Bar was also traced to the defendants. Liaquat of Middlemore Road, Khan of Lones Road, both West Bromwich, and Sawane of no fixed address will be sentenced at a later date. Hand broken by tackling shoplifters. A man who owned stalls at a market in the Black Country broke his hand after stopping scummy shoplifters from stealing items. Sean Russell from Oldbury owns six stalls at Blackheath Market in Rowley Regis and said thieves stealing items from his stalls was a daily occurrence. He said two men had attempted to steal items from one of his stalls on May 16th, but the goods were recovered, and the men then returned 2 days later. Mr. Russell said that the scummy shoplifters grabbed fairy washing pods and made off, but they had already been clocked by another manager in the market and he ran after them. Mr. Russell said he managed to catch one of the men, but suffered a broken hand and three fractures in his thumb in his efforts to try and stop the pair of shoplifters. He said, "For us, it's a daily occurrence. Compared to supermarkets, who, unfortunately, their policies are let them take what they want. For me, I am the boss, and my message is that they are not taking what is mine." The incident comes after Sean Egan, who had worked in the Morrison's store in Aldridge for 29 years, was sacked for tackling a shoplifter. Mr. Egan, 46, spent nearly three decades working at the store before being dismissed for tackling a shoplifter in December last year. He intervened when a repeat shoplifter turned abusive. This ultimately cost him his position, as it went against Morrison's strict deter not detain policy for all frontline staff and management. Knife recovered and man held in burglary probe. A 23-year-old man has been arrested by West Midlands Police on suspicion of aggravated burglary, dangerous driving and possession of a knife. The arrest was made in Oldbury yesterday by police investigating an aggravated burglary which took place at 9 a.m. at a home in Hales Owen. At the home, entry was gained and a vehicle stolen. The suspect later returned to the address in possession of a Rambo knife, police said. Officers chased the vehicle on Church Bridge, Oldbury, heading towards Junction 2 of the M5. The vehicle was driving down the wrong side of the carriageway at the junction's roundabout and attempted to join the motorway. Police officers made contact on the slip road and stopped the vehicle, preventing it from entering the motorway network on the wrong side. The man was arrested by firearms officers on suspicion of aggravated burglary, dangerous driving and possession of a knife. He was taken into custody, where police said he remains as inquiries continued. A Rambo-style knife was recovered from the vehicle. The slip road at Junction 2 was closed for a short time as the incident was dealt with. Music festival on the move as event made free to attend. A popular music festival celebrating Black Country culture is set to become a free event after organisers cited financial concerns and issues. The Black Country Music Festival had been set to take place at Himley Hall on July the 11th, following the success of the 2025 event at the same venue. However, the organising committee said it had made the decision to move the festival to Stone Square Street in Dudley Town Centre and to make it free to attend. James Stevens, a member of the organising committee, said difficulty in selling tickets and recognition of a tough time financially for people had caused the committee to make the decision to ensure the festival could keep going. He said, "As a few people may already have heard, we have made the decision to move this year's Black Country Music Festival from Himley Hall to Stone Street Square in Dudley Town Centre. There are a number of reasons behind the move, the main one being the current difficulty in selling tickets. We are determined to keep the festival going, but we also recognise that it's a tough time financially for many people. As a result, we have decided to make the event free to attend. All artists have now been informed and ticket buyers have been refunded. We are currently finalising the revised lineup following the move and expect to publish full details within the next couple of days. We would like to thank everyone for their patience and continued support, and we look forward to seeing you all for a fantastic free day of music in Dudley Town Centre on July the 11th. For more information on the Black Country Music Festival, go to the festival website."
Hello, this is Trevor reading articles from the Express and Star for Tuesday, the 26th of May. New National Forest could be planted in the Midlands. The West Midlands is in the running for a new National Forest funded by more than £7 million of government funding. Tens of thousands of trees could be planted across the region as part of a nationwide scheme. The new forest has been given a funding boost of up to £7.5 million the government has announced, but it says it has yet to decide where to create the new green space. It says the new forest will be either in the Midlands or North England, but has not made any more specific. It's expected to be between 200 and 600 square miles and will focus on supporting healthy communities through the investment. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, said it will be one of the three new national forests in England which Labour pledged to establish in its manifesto. On Monday, the department announced that the government had committed up to £7.5 million over a five-year period to support the forest and called for delivery partners to submit bids to help deliver the new project. The funding forms part of the government's commitment to investments of more than £1 billion this Parliament in tree planting and to support the forestry sector. The first of the new forests was announced in March last year, stretching from the Cotswolds to the Mendips in the west of England. Planting has already begun here, with a new project expected to see more than 20 million trees planted across Bristol, Wiltshire, Gloucestershire and Somerset by 2050. The department said another new forest has been planned for the Oxford-Cambridge-Oxcam corridor. Nature Minister Mary Creo said she was looking forward to create a new forest further north. She said, "In our manifesto, we promised three new national forests, and after the Western Forest and the Oxcam Arc Forest, we're looking for England's newest forest in the Midlands or North. Too many communities can't access the green spaces that benefit mental and physical health. The new National Forest will help change that." Albion coaches hope Mossa will help young talents thrive. This article is by Lewis Cox. Albion are optimistic new boss James Morrison is the right man at the helm to allow the club's burgeoning youngsters flourish. There is expectation within the corridors at the Hawthorns that the next crop of teens to push towards the first team squad could be among the brightest for several years. Academy boss Richard Stevens and his staff have worked tirelessly to move the youth setup in the right direction and continue to offer prospects a pathway to the first team. The appointment of former youth coach Morrison as first team boss could work in the youngsters' favour. Difficult times off the field with the previous ownership of Gouch and Lye meant some major baggage youth talent was all too easily poached, particularly to nearby neighbours Villa. Albion's place in the pecking order remains below Villa, and talent can always be susceptible to money spinning offers, but staff are hopeful the rising crop believe they are in the right place. "We've got some amazing talent at this football club," said under-18s boss Shay Thompson, who guided his side to a record Premier League South finish of fifth this term. "There are players pushing on with the likes of Harry Whitwell, Ollie Bostock, SEL Sule and Suleiman Mande in and around the first team. There are even more coming through in this academy. With the right pathway and guidance, they can go far. There's a lot of communication with the club head coach, James Morrison, knows these young players having worked in the academy, and we know the club are watching who's doing well and impressing, which is great to have. Albion's under-18s have sparked this season with striker Harry French, the top scorer, and the likes of Justin 77, Jaden Francis Caesar, Rio Palmer and Remar McNeil, making up an exciting attacking unit. McNeil and French have signed first professional deals and an offer has been made to Francis Caesar. Albion's under-17s reached the semi-final of the Premier League Cup. The FA Youth Cup ended in an unfortunate fourth round penalty shootout defeat at Sunderland. "We focused on being more competitive and the lads have got some good results from it," Thompson added. "We've had some games where we performed at a really high level. We just wanted to finish as high as we could in the league and get the lads to push on. With some of them earning professional contracts, we've got a lot of players over the line in that respect and are incredibly proud of our staff and players." Opening date for bakery's new shop revealed. This article's by James Vukmirovic. A baking chain best known for its iconic burnt top cups and range of great and affordable bakes has announced when its new shop will open. Bake My Day has become a popular chain for its brand of traditional burnt top cups, freshly baked cakes and bakes and range of sandwiches, with queues being seen out of the door of the three chain stores in Greatbridge, Blackheath and Albury. The stores are owned and run by Nathan Hadley, who worked with a team of five to start baking at 3 a.m. with staff also working at the different stores to bake cronuts, eclairs and other dishes popular with customers. The chain recently announced on social media that we'll be bringing the Bake My Day brand and taste to another Sandwell town after announcing it's taken up a shop on Union Street in Wensbury near the bus stop next to Morrison's. It has now announced that the new store will open next month at 9 a.m. on June the 9th. A spokesman for Bake My Day said, "Guys, we have some exciting news as the grand opening of our new store in Wensbury will be on June the 9th at 9 a.m. Can't wait to see you all there to grab all your crusty cups and fresh cakes." Arrest after more than 100 boxes of nitrous oxide found in shop. A man has been arrested after more than 100 boxes of nitrous oxide bottles were found in a shop in Wensbury. Officer from West Midlands Police spotted suspicious activity outside the shop on the High Street while on patrol on May the 21st. After entering the store, police recovered 126 boxes of nitrous oxide bottles, which had an estimated street value of £15,000 and a quantity of illegal cigarettes. A man aged 19 was arrested on suspicion of possession with intent to supply Class C drugs, but was bailed pending further inquiries. A spokesperson for West Midlands Police said, "We're taking tough action against high street stores in the West Midlands, which are funding organised crime through sales of illicit goods and fuelling antisocial behaviour and violence. Suspected drug dealers have been arrested and thousands of pounds worth of counterfeit tobacco and illegal vapes have been seized as we work with partners including Trading Standards, HMRC and Immigration. If there's evidence of criminal activity or links to organised crime, then we'll always look to ensure charges and seek secure orders on premises. We urge anyone with any information to contact us and our partners, as the more evidence and intelligence we receive means we'll have a better opportunity of combating any legal activity. You can do this via live chat on our website or by calling 101. Alternatively, contact Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111. Police launch electric bikes in war on antisocial behaviour. This article is by Mark Andrews. Police in the back country are being issued with 32 electric bikes, which will become the latest weapon in the fight against neighbourhood crime. The £59,200 new fleet was launched in Dudley after Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster made the funding available. Mr Foster said the bike could travel at speeds of up to 15.5 miles an hour with electric assistance, allowing for rapid response times while still maintaining the visible presence and approachability of officers on traditional cycles. They are now fully operational in high streets and neighbourhoods across the West Midlands region. he said, it is believed that 10 of them will be deployed in the Dudley area, but Mr. Foster, he was open to increasing the numbers if they proved effective. Mr. Foster said the bikes were being introduced following a successful trial in Birmingham, which demonstrated how officers were able to cover more ground than foot patrols while remaining more accessible and visible than those in police cars. He said it was part of his commitment to increase the number of officers on bicycles and on foot. Mr. Foster said the bikes would allow officers to reach areas where traditional vehicles struggle to operate, helping to drive down neighbourhood crime. He said, I'm committed to rebuilding community policing because I know that an accessible, reassuring and visible police presence is exactly what our communities want and need. These new e-bikes are a smart, effective investment that will ensure our officers are more than accessible and visible and better equipped to prevent and tackle crime. By getting officers out of cars and onto our streets, we are building the trust and confidence that is essential to keeping people, families, businesses and communities safe and secure. Inspector Miles Patterson of Dudley Police Division said they would allow officers to reach their destinations in less than half the time they would on a traditional bike, and would also preserve their energy for which they could reach incidents. They would be used by neighbourhood teams to deal with local problems. He said, driving in a car gets you from A to B faster, but you probably miss out on vital information because you've got the windows up and people can't flag you down so easily, he added. You've got a better opportunity to engage your members of the local community or understand the issues that are going on, seek to resolve them and gather intelligence. Chief Inspector Adam Henderson, in charge of neighbourhood policing in the borough, added, these e-bikes are a fantastic addition to our operational toolkit. They allow our officers to patrol larger areas more frequently while maintaining that vital face-to-face connection with the public. Operationally, they give us the ability to respond quickly to neighbourhood issues and reach areas the patrol cars simply can't.
Hi everybody, this is Rosie and I'm reading the quiz for you this week. And we're going to start with some questions about the news and what's been going on over the last week or so. Hopefully you will know all the answers. Number one. How many points did the UK's Eurovision entry Look Mum No Computer finish with? Number two, what aircraft could go back into production 90 years after its first flight thanks to a team of aviation enthusiasts? Number three, a new 50p collectible coin was launched by the Royal Mint on Wednesday, celebrating the 25th anniversary of which film series? Number 4. What did the rate of consumer prices index, CPI, inflation fall to in April? Number 5. Social media influencers on TikTok have helped what reach the height of culinary fashion, according to Tesco? Number 6. Arsenal have been crowned Premier League champions for the first time in how many years? Number 7. Which government project is set to cost between £87.7 billion and £102.7 billion? Number 8. Three women who starred in which reality television show have accused their co-stars of sexual misconduct? Number 9. Which football star is set to become the first to take part in 6 World Cups after it was announced he will play in this summer's tournament? And the last one, number 10. Who have been announced by the BBC as the new hosts of Strictly Come Dancing? Here are the questions again, this time along with the answers to the news round of the quiz. Number 1. How many points did the UK's Eurovision entry Look Mum No Computer finish with? And it finished with a whopping 1 point. Number 2. What aircraft could go back into production 90 years after its first flight thanks to a team of aviation enthusiasts. And that is the Super Marine. Number 3. A new 50p collectible coin was launched by the Royal Mint on Wednesday, celebrating the 25th anniversary of which film series? And that is The Lord of the Rings. Number 4. What did the rate of consumer prices index, the CPI, inflation fall to in April? And it fell to 2.8%. Number 5. Social media influencers on TikTok have helped what reach the height of culinary fashion, according to Tesco? And that is tinned tuna. Number 6. Arsenal have been crowned Premier League champions for the first time in how many years? And that is 22 years. Number 7. Which government project is set to cost between £87.7 billion and £102.7 billion? And that's the HS2 project. Number 8. Three women who starred in which reality television show have accused their co-stars of sexual misconduct? And that's Married at First Sight. Number 9. Which football star is set to become the first to take part in 6 World Cups after it was announced he will play in this summer's tournament? And that's Cristiano Ronaldo. And the last one, number 10. Who have been announced by the BBC as the new hosts of Strictly Come Dancing? And they are Emma Willis, Josh Widdicombe and Johannes Radebe. I hope you guys all did well this week. Bye for now.
We must now be clear about how your information is used and the steps we take to ensure it is secure. When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending the Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio described TV programmes for the period Saturday, 30th of May to Friday, 5th of June 2026. So, starting with Saturday, the 30th of May, today starts with the usual triple bill of the sitcom Frasier at 9:10, followed by 4 episodes of The Simpsons at 10:50, both on Channel 4. There is live coverage of 2 rugby league finals today from Wembley Stadium, starting with the Women's Challenge Cup final between Wigan Warriors and St Helens on BBC Two, kick-off 11:45 a.m. Wigan Warriors meet Hull Kingston Rovers in the Men's Challenge Cup final on BBC One, kick-off 3 p.m. Although these events are not audio described, the commentary should give you an idea of the action. The chef ends his trip in New York in James Martin's American Adventure on ITV1 at 12:30 p.m. Cast your mind back to 1983, when Shergar, the world's most valuable racehorse of the era, was abducted at gunpoint from Ballymoney Stud in County Kildare. Decades later, the mystery of what became of Shergar remains unsolved. Tonight's documentary, Shergar, the Racehorse and the IRA, on Channel 4 at 8 p.m, investigates. In today's visit to the hospital drama Casualty on BBC One at 8:25 p.m, Flynn uncovers more evidence on Bard. Spade interrogates the intruder and learns that there are some people who still very much want him dead. The drama Monsieur Spade continues on the You and Drama channel at 9 p.m. Dan fights to win Zoe back in tonight's episode of the drama 2 Weeks in August on BBC One at 9:15 p.m. The action drama Taken, starring Liam Neeson, is tonight's late film on ITV One at 10:50 p.m. On to Sunday, 31st of May. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. Live audio-described coverage of the Women's FA Cup final, when Brighton and Hove Albion meet Manchester, is on Channel 4, kick-off 3 p.m. The Naturalist and team travel to the mountains of Kyrgyzstan on a mission to witness the snow leopard. Expedition with Steve Batchel is on BBC Two at 5:25 p.m. In tonight's episode of Death Valley on BBC One at 8:15, Janie and John investigate when a junior member of a TV crew overdoses in an actor's trailer. Staying on BBC One, this is followed at 9 p.m. with the drama Dear England. Gareth Southgate's guilt weighs heavily on his conscience in the aftermath of a devastating defeat at Wembley. A three-part documentary series starts tonight investigating a charity for seriously ill children launched by a teenager who is battling a brain tumour. However, the charity was perhaps not what it seemed. The Mother of All Cons is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. A new tense thriller, Tiptoe, from writer Russell T Davies, starts tonight on Channel 4 at 9. A minor feud starts to escalate into danger when Leo gives his next-door neighbour his spare key. Continues tomorrow at the same time. A new series of the Australian drama following members of a jury at a murder trial starts tonight. A cold case from 1968 draws attention when a person researching it is killed. The first two episodes of Cape Rock Killer start at 10:45 p.m. on ITV One. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. On BBC One, Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:15 a.m, Bargain Hunt is at 12:15, and Great Continental Railway Journeys is at 6:30 p.m, Monday to Friday. Natalie Cassidy, Caring Together, is at 2 p.m, Monday to Thursday only. Dickinson's Real Deal is on ITV One at 2 p.m, Monday to Friday. On Channel 4, there are four episodes of the sitcom Frasier, starting at 9:10, Monday to Friday. On ITV3, there are two episodes of Heartbeat, starting at 5:50 and 6:55 p.m, Monday to Friday. Now for Monday, 1st of June. More adventures on the UK's canals in Narrow Escapes on Channel 4 at 4 p.m. Kelvin faces a devastating loss when a three-day-old lamb breaks its leg. Fletcher's Family Farm is on ITV One at 7:30 p.m. A young, handsome and charismatic priest joins the parish in The Brokenwood Mysteries on the You and Drama channel at 8 p.m. There are more than 1.5 million women of reproductive age in the UK who suffer from endometriosis, an excruciatingly painful condition for which there is no cure. The broadcaster Emma Barnett meets some of the women, like her, who must live with its effects. Emma Barnett, Fighting Endometriosis, is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. The final episode of the drama Dear England is on BBC One at 9. As Euro 2024 begins, the team struggles and pressure mounts. The second part of the drama Tiptoe is on Channel 4 at 9. Tuesday, 2nd of June. In the semi-final of Interior Design Masters with Alan Carr on BBC One at 8pm, the three remaining designers head to Brighton and Hove Albion Football Club Stadium to transform two hospitality boxes each. In tonight's episode of Bake Off the Professionals, the remaining five teams must create 24 identical Battenberg cakes and the same number of reinvented versions of the cake. Catch up with them on Channel 4 at 8pm. Several choices at 9 tonight. The Strictly Come Dancing professional, Amy Dowden, looks into her family tree in tonight's episode of Who Do You Think You Are on BBC One. A new documentary series, The Vardys, starts on ITV One at 9, following Jamie Vardy and family as they start a new life in Italy. Continues at the same time, Tuesday and Wednesday. Anna realises how much things have changed for her and seeks some guidance. The drama The Falling is on Channel 4 at 9. When Amanda Blakefield is left an enormous inheritance by a man she has neither met nor heard of before, her life starts to fall apart. The new drama The Fortune starts on Channel 5 at 9. Continues at the same time tomorrow. Events spiral toward an intense and devastating conclusion in the final episode of Half Man on BBC One at 10:40pm. In the documentary Witness, Fergal Keane's Journey of Hope on BBC Two at 11pm, the journalist explains why he is still full of hope after four decades covering war, genocide and famine, and argues that the answer lies in the bravery he has witnessed. On to Wednesday, the 3rd of June. The professor examines nuclear fusion in tonight's episode of The Future with Hannah Fry on BBC Two at 7:30pm. We meet a bunch of excitable staffy puppies in For the Love of Dogs with Alison Hammond on ITV One at 7:30. In tonight's episode of MasterChef on BBC One at 8pm, the finalists jet off to the Caribbean to face challenges designed to broaden their culinary horizons. Amanda attempts to persuade Felicity to give her the money she needs to buy a house. Amandaland is on BBC One at 9pm. We look at the work of surgeons and their teams as they undertake critical operations in Scotland. Surgeons at the Edge of Life is on BBC Two at 9. The final episode of the drama The Falling is on Channel 4 at 9pm. Thursday, 4th of June. Finals week continues in MasterChef on BBC One at 8pm. A widow wants to preserve her late husband's memories as well as future-proof her home. George Clark's Beautiful Builds is on Channel 4 at 8pm. In Edinburgh, a search begins for a missing Chinese student. Reported missing is on BBC One at 9pm. We are shown the footballer's meteoric rise to fame in David Beckham in 10 pictures on BBC Two at 9. Four contestants are in with a realistic chance of becoming the 21st Taskmaster champion. Taskmaster is on Channel 4 at 9pm. Keen to thank the staff, the Hardacres throw a servant's ball, where the staff will be waited on by the family. The Hardacres is on Channel 5 at 9pm. And so we come to Friday, the 5th of June. In their final challenge, the cooks serve a three-course menu, but will they have done enough to impress the judges? Find out in MasterChef The Final on BBC One at 8pm. Kate Quilton investigates the uncertainty over summer holidays ever since jet fuel prices have soared and caused thousands of flights to be cancelled. Will My Summer Holidays Be Cancelled is on Channel 4 at 8pm. We follow the teams who look after two of the National Trust's most unusual houses in Hidden Treasures of the National Trust on BBC One at 9 p.m. A new series of Celebrity Gogglebox starts on Channel 4 at 9. Agnes Gate crashes Cathy's book club. Mrs. Brown's Boys is on BBC One at 9:30 p.m. And we end the week with a double bill of the hospital drama St. Denis Medical on BBC One at 10:40 p.m. I do hope that you find something in this week's selection that will appeal to you.
And now for a look at this week's radio recommendations, compiled by Angela and read by Gilly. Starting with Saturday the 30th of May and comedy, the inimitable P.G. Wodehouse celebrates the works of the author with his characters brought to life by Simon Cadell, Michael Horden and Richard Briers. It's on at a choice of times on Radio 4 Extra, 10 a.m, 3 p.m. or 9 p.m. The Miles Davis story continues. Clark Peters looks at the jazz musician's battle with heroin addiction and how he looked to his boxing idols, Jack Johnson and Sugar Ray Robinson, for strength and discipline to overcome his demons. That's The Miles Davis Story at 10:30 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated on Monday the 1st of June at 4:30 p.m. Today's Radio 4 drama is a two-parter. Starting today, of The King Must Die, Mary Renault's novel based on the myth of Theseus. The young hero sets out to solve the mystery of his birth and follow his destiny. It's on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Arsenal fans will be sure to tune into the Champions League final as the Gunners take on Paris Saint-Germain. Enjoy the build-up from 4 p.m. with live commentary starting at 5 p.m. on Radio 5. Finally, for Saturday the 30th of May, Archive on 4 brings us a collection of archive recordings of Muhammad Ali, including interviews, commentary, poetry and song, to mark the 10th anniversary of his death. Archive on 4, the Louisville Lip, is at 8 p.m. on Radio 4. On to Sunday the 31st of May. Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs this week is former motorcycle racer Guy Martin. It's at 10 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated on Friday the 5th of June at 9 a.m. Geraldine James stars in today's Radio 4 drama Moon Tiger, Penelope Lively's 1987 novel of love, loss and the importance of memory. As her daughter interrogates her about her past, a dying historian attempts to piece together a history of her life. Moon Tiger is at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Alternatively, on Radio 3 at the same time is Music Matters, Mark Radcliffe's Nature Ramblings, an exploration of music works inspired by the natural world. Tune in to Radio 3 at 3 p.m. It's followed by Jazz Record Requests and recordings by, among others, Dave Brubeck, Ella Fitzgerald and Miles Davis at 4 p.m. on Radio 3. And now a look at those programmes which are broadcast each weekday at the same time. Book of the Week is The Street Clinic, specialist mental health nurse Dorcas Gawata's memoir of working with people affected by knife crime in London. At 11:45 a.m. each day on Radio 4 and repeated at 12:30 a.m. each night. To mark what would have been her 100th birthday comes Bombshell, Five Faces of Marilyn Monroe, a look at the life and myths of the Hollywood legend. The opening episode explores how Monroe crafted a sympathetic backstory for herself, blurring reality and fantasy, at 1:45 p.m. each day on Radio 4. Composer of the Week is Surrey-born composer and conductor Arthur Bliss, 1891 to 1975. Donald MacLeod
is joined by Bliss's biographer, Paul Spicer, as they chart his early years during World War I. Influences such as Vaughan Williams and Stravinsky and the impact of the death of his brother, at 4 p.m. each day on Radio 3. The essay this week explores the life and legacy of five lesser-known contemporaries of the most famous Soviet symphonist, Dmitri Shostakovich, each of whom also had a turbulent relationship with the authorities. That's the essay, The Other Shostakoviches, each night at 9:45 p.m. on Radio 3. John of John by Douglas Stewart continues in the book at bedtime slot, each night at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4. Now, here are some individual programmes to listen to throughout the week, starting with Monday the 1st of June. In Siblings Unpicked, comedian and actor Stephen Mangan and his sister Anita delve into their sibling relationship with the help of psychotherapist Philippa Perry. A serious subject, as the programme looks at the psychological, emotional and scientific facts, but often hilarious thanks to this winning brother and sister partnership. Siblings Unpicked is at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. In this week's Conversations from a Long Marriage, starring Joanna Lumley and Roger Allam, Joanna is enchanted by two seagull chicks nesting on the porch roof, while Roger is concerned that a widowed friend has brought a guest to stay with them, who looks just like Joanna. It's at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Now, to Tuesday, 2nd of June. The series The Gift continues. It is a criminal offence to take an at-home DNA test in France, and Audrey and Arthur must break the law if they want to unlock the truths hidden in their genes. The Gift is at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated on Wednesday, the 3rd of June at 9 p.m. The drama Our Friends in the North continues. The year is 1966, and Mary and Tosca are married and bringing up their baby in a new high-rise council flat. However, both the flat and the marriage are already showing cracks. At 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Radio 3 in Concert comes live from the Wigmore Hall tonight as Martin Handley introduces Norwegian opera star Lise Davidson and South African-born pianist James Baillieu in an evening of songs by Franz Schubert. The concert starts at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Finally, for Tuesday the 2nd of June, In Touch, the programme for the visually impaired, with Peter White, is at 8:45 p.m. on Radio 4. Wednesday the 3rd of June. Today's Radio 4 drama is Relocation, Relocation, a comedy drama set in a secondary school. Sir Ken is trying to force through a restructure, which means that some staff will be relocated to more challenging schools, at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. And more drama today, with a dramatisation of Neville Shute's 1940 novel, Hidden Treasures, Landfall. RAF pilot Jerry Chambers is patrolling the skies above the south coast of England when he becomes implicated in a tragic military disaster. Can he clear his name after being blamed for the sinking of a British submarine? A choice of times, 2:30 p.m. or 8:30 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Thursday the 4th of June. There's a new series of Bottom Line with Evan Davis. Following the first sub-2-hour marathon, he examines the manufacture of running shoes and trainers at 12:04 on Radio 4. Today's drama is The London Recruits. In 1970, as apartheid grips South Africa, an ANC exile in London recruits sympathisers to fly out to Cape Town as tourists and plant seeds from which resistance against the regime can start to grow. The London Recruits is at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. In this week's Ramblings, Claire Balding explores the south side of Anglesey with friends Emily Coates and Nick Parry, who discuss what makes the area so special to them at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. And finally, on to Friday the 5th of June. Amphibians are the most threatened type of vertebrates. Why are they in danger, and can we save them? Find out in Rare Earth, Eye of Frog, Toe of Newt at 12:04 p.m. on Radio 4. When Sudanese pizza delivery driver Mo arrives at a Cardiff house, he finds a dead body. Convinced he will be a suspect, Mo decides not to alert the authorities and flees the crime scene, but he can't stop thinking about the dead woman. That's today's drama, Limelight, The Courier, at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Finally, why not end this week with Mylene Klass and her selection of relaxing music designed to ease away the stresses and strains of the day? Tune in to Calm Classics on Classic FM at 10 p.m. Happy listening.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Heather with two stories written by Fiona about how family support is helping people meet the challenges of visual impairment. First, we're off to Nigeria, where 15 years ago, a neighbour visited Elizabeth Akuwu in Plateau State, Nigeria, to congratulate her on the birth of her son. But she claimed that the one-week-old baby was eyeing her. The infant's mother laughed off the comment. How could a week-old baby eye anyone, Elizabeth wondered. But in an interview with Punch Healthwise, a newspaper which focuses on public health and development in Nigeria, Elizabeth explained that when she tried to make eye contact with her son, Tinafi, the unsettling truth became clear. The baby's eyes would not follow her movements. There was no connection, no visual engagement that typically marks the early bond between mother and child. A visit to the doctor when Tinafi was 2 years old revealed a diagnosis of congenital nystagmus, a condition where the eyes make repetitive, uncontrolled movements, severely impairing vision. And there's no cure for this condition. Tinafi, however, soon revealed he was a boy who could rise to this challenge. Elizabeth asserted that every child, disabled or not, comes packed full with talents, while the parent's job is to discover and nurture those gifts. Overcoming bullying at school and with Elizabeth's encouragement, Tinafi's childhood curiosity soon embraced technology. His passion crystallised in primary four when a teacher introduced him to computer programming. Talking to Punch Healthwise, he explained, after computer class or any time I'm free, I would go to his office and ask him questions about different stuff and ask him to teach me. Through tutorials, online courses and teaching himself to code, Tinafi's knowledge led him to begin designing apps for other people with visual impairments. Tinafi's first major app, T-Vision, emerged from a moment of frustration and fear. One day in secondary school, he needed to get to class, but no one was available to guide him. His school's large campus, dotted with drains and gutters, was treacherous terrain for someone with severely limited vision. Tinafi said, I was just thinking to myself while going for the class, why not have an app that uses AI to just simply direct you and tell you when there are obstacles and what exactly to do, instead of always actively relying on human help? And so his T-Vision app was born. T-Vision uses conversational artificial intelligence to guide visually impaired users. The app not only alerts users to obstacles and dangerous objects, but also provides step-by-step navigation to help them reach their destination. The teenager describes the app as a social companion and a compass, a visual guide or a visual assistant that is right there to help the visually impaired. Talking about his mum, Elizabeth, he said, my mum always used to tell me that I'm not blind. She'd encourage me and say that I should never bother about these things. And honestly, that has really shaped who I have actually become as a person today. And now, in a different part of the world, we find another inspirational mother in Yonkers, New York. Speaking to Sarah Goldstein in an interview for Yahoo Life, mum Kiara Glanton explained how, when her daughter was 3 years old, everything changed. An autoimmune disease that had been affecting Kiana's vision for years reached a turning point. She was moving from visual impairment to legal blindness. As a single mum navigating New York City with a preschool daughter, she had to work out how to cope. Kiana discovered Lighthouse Guild, which for more than 200 years has provided care, technology, training and community to help people with vision loss to live life fully and independently. First, Kiana learned how to use a cane and invited her daughter to become her partner in navigating the world. Together, they developed a system of hand squeezes at pedestrian crossings and picked out bejeweled canes to match their outfits. The first thing I learned how to do was to use my cane to get my daughter back and forth to school, Kiana explained. My mobility instructor would let me hold my daughter on my left side and my cane in my right side. He taught me the skills, how to cross the street, how to listen for the traffic passing by, how to listen for the wind, feel the sun on my face, and to interpret east and west. And he taught my daughter as well. My daughter very early would squeeze my hand when the crossing signal would change. She would squeeze two hands if she felt she was unsure. So two squeezes, I'm not sure. One hand squeeze is, let's go, mummy. And this became part of the team effort to get us back and forth. I wanted to make sure she felt included and that she understood that she was important, but that mummy was the leader in this and we were going to do this together. Now, at 42, Kiana is the captain of Team USA's blind baseball team. She works full-time using adaptive technology and is raising her now 10-year-old daughter, who she calls her seeing eye daughter. Speaking about her daughter, Kiana said, "Motherhood has been a gift. I don't know what my life would look like if I wasn't her mum." This particular child is a reflection of possibility for someone who had an autoimmune disease, an impending visual impairment and blindness. This child didn't care and doesn't care about it. That's the last thing she thinks about. She thinks I'm cool.
DNF Soundings.
In early May, I think it was, I was fortunate enough to join a few people on a visit to the Fixed Wheel Brewery, which is a microbrewery in Blackheath. And a very enjoyable afternoon it was, quite warm and sunny, though nothing like the weather we've had over this bank holiday. But that bank holiday, the weather was nice and warm and not so challenging. Here's the first part. Sorry if there's a bit of background noise, but you will be able to hear, though, what our guide around the brewery had to tell us about the fascinating business of brewing.
My name is Jacob. I'm the brewer here at Fixed Wheel. For a short period of time, I was the youngest professional brewer in the UK, so I'll just throw my credentials right at the top of the day. We're in Fixed Wheel Brewery. We're a small craft microbrewery in Blackheath, and we've been here for about 12 years. And so, we'll start with a question. Can you list off the four key ingredients in beer for me?
Hops.
Hops, perfect.
Oats.
Grain or grist or some other old English word that's been around for longer than I have.
Barley's whiskey, isn't it?
Yeah, barley's still used in beer as well. That falls into the grain category. And then the other two are yeast and water. I can't show you yeast and water because, you know, you just but I can show you the barley and the malt and the hops. So in this glass here, if I could have you hold your hands out for me so that you can all feel. There we go. They are. Here you are. Can I have your hand, mate?
The smell of hops.
Is that where you're from?
You used to go into Sheffield and you'd pass over the bridge, Tetley Ales. Mm. And the smell of hops.
Smell of the Tetley Brewery, yeah?
Yeah. It's gone now, but.
Yeah. So in your hands, you're holding Pilsner malt, which has been milled, it's been steeped, and that is a process that we basically use once the grain has been harvested. We steep it so that the sprouts just begin to grow, and at that point we immediately kill it off and we start cooking it and we start drying it out in a big kiln. And the temperature and the length for how long you heat it in a kiln depend on the change the flavour profile of the barley that you're using. So in your hand, you should be feeling sort of three textures, which is the husk, which is the big sort of skinny flaky bits, which is sort of the skin of the seed, the grist, which is sort of the more chunky white bits, and then the flour. And your ratio of these to one another is all dependent on what kit you've got and how much extract you're expecting to get from the grain. And so when we sprout it, what we're doing is we're making all the sugars that are in the grain accessible to us so that we can then convert them into a liquid form to then follow through and take into the beer and ferment them. You can put all that back now. I won't make you carry it around the whole time. There you are. There you are. So we've also got wheat, which is another thing we use. The wheat adds protein into beers, which gives it more head. This one here is amber malt, so just smell this one for me, mate. So this one is a lot darker in colour and has been more roasted to sort of bring out more chocolatey or earthy tones. I believe that this is Crystal, Crystal 240, so feel free to have a little taste of that and stuff. And it's very chocolatey, this one. It is absolutely lovely to use. Yeah, feel free to have a taste of the smell.
Darker beer.
Darker beers and stuff. I don't unfortunately have any of the full roast in today, so this is the darkest one I've got. But you can get from it all the nice sort of caramelly, chocolatey sort of flavours and stuff. And so this one would have been roasted for a longer period of time. And for the most part, what I've heard from millers is they don't time any of it. They just sort of know by looking where it's at, and that's just how they do it, apparently. I wouldn't know, I've never. So now then, we'll go into the hops, which are used in the kettle. We'll go through all the kit in a minute. In the kettle, we boil the liquid, and then we add the hops in. That adds in bitterness through a thing called lupulin, which once we've got the hops out, you'll be able to actually see it. It's like a sort of nice yellowy powder. Here, you boil it up, the smells of these. I can't actually remember. That one here is Citra, so this is an aroma hop. So the purpose of boiling it is to activate those lupulin compounds. And obviously I can't boil the hops at the minute. And there you go. So now the smell is a lot sweeter and a lot less harsh.
And your hands are stained.
And my hands are stained and they'll be sticky for the rest of the day. There's no way to get rid of that. So that's Citra, that's an aroma hop, so that gets added at the end of the boil because all of those smells and stuff that you get there are really sensitive. And so if you boil them for too long, you'll flash them off in the steam. I think this is one called Magnum, but I'm not that sure. There we go. This one's a bit bitterer and sort of stronger. This one is from... Where's this one from? I think this one's grown in Slovakia. And so where hops are grown also changes their flavour profile completely. Just through the soils and the temperature. So the Citra is from Washington State in America. Sorry, pal, do you want to move forward? There we go. Where a lot more aromatic hops come from. Recently, there's been a big surge in New Zealand hops, and they're really skunky and green. And then as well as old traditional English hops are grown sort of all over. Mostly Worcester is where we get all of ours. And for those... That's the hops and barley. And we can now go to the first bit of kit. So if you all want to follow me again.
These imported ingredients, they must cost a bit coming that distance.
They do.
America and New Zealand?
America, New Zealand, Germany, Slovakia we get a lot from. And then a lot of the malt, if it's not grown in the UK, is grown in Ukraine. And so obviously all them prices have surged up recently. Anyway, so what we're standing at here is the mash tun, which is directly next to our hot liquor tank. This is kept at about 78 degrees, and then all this water is adjusted because the pH levels and the salt levels and the acidity all change the texture of the beer in the final product. So you may know that Burton upon Trent is a very famous sort of town for brewing. That's because the river's a lot chalkier, and that gives the beer a drier texture at the end when it comes through the tap. And so we try and replicate that here. We just use mains water. A lot of breweries will have wells that are hundreds of years old that they use. The water will get mixed in with the grain in the mash tun here, and it will be somewhere between 62 and sort of 70 degrees if you're really pushing it. And the differences in using them temperatures is it all depends how sweet you want your final beer to be. So the higher temperature you go, the less fermentable sugar you'll get, which means that at the end, when it's coming out the tap, more of them sugars are in the beer, making it slightly sweeter. Actually, I think I've done that backwards. Sorry, you get more fermentable sugars the higher you go, and the lower you go, you get less fermentable sugars. So when the malt is held at these temperatures, the enzymes are released, and they're the most active, and they start breaking down the chains of sugar. which is what allows the yeast to be able to use them in the fermenter to produce alcohol. And it's different for lager brewing. So in lager brewing, what you'll do is you'll start it at around 45 degrees and then you'll gradually increase the temperature. And you do this because traditionally German malts are less adapted than, say, English malts are. And so the enzymes need more work to be able to release them for all that efficiency. So you'll be able to feel in, you'll be able to feel all the smooth sides, and the door is just below sort of at waist height. And then we've also got the mash plate at the bottom, which you'll be able to feel if you sort of crouch down and reach in the door.
It's not like a big washing machine.
It is essentially a big washing machine, and it's bloody hard work stirring it. And so the plate at the bottom basically filters all out the filters all that mash out, which is what it's called out there at this point. And by then, the liquid will have gained its colour from the malt, and it'll be now be called wort, or brewer's breakfast if you're an old brewer, which is good for hangovers. It's really good for hangovers.
So what do you do with all the stuff that's coming through the bottom?
So once it all strains out, the wort will then go through another filter. Before going into the kettle where it'll be boiled, the grist inside will dig out, which is bloody hard work and very sweaty, and then that is all repurposed as animal feed. And so there's a lot of rules. There's no waste other than energy, pretty much. It's the three biggest things that all breweries spend on is labour, electricity or energy, and raw materials.
I might add, for those who can't see this, the one I'm standing next to is about shoulder high, maybe 5 foot six or thereabouts.
Something around there. The door is a bit lower where we can dig out of. Yeah. Previously, I didn't have a door, and so to dig it out, I would have to climb inside with a bag and a shovel and throw it all over. I'm very grateful we now have a door.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This morning we have Debbie Heath in the studio once again to review another audio book by Adam Kay called This Is Going to Hurt. And this is a novel set in the medical world of junior doctors and the NHS. So shall we talk a bit about Adam Kay, the author?
He was a junior doctor between 2004 and 2011. And this book chronicles some of his experiences. It's like a James Herriot type book, but about junior doctors, but with a bit more of a social undertone. Is that the political undertone? It's not spoiling the story because it says right at the beginning that Adam stopped practicing medicine after about 5-6 years. What is very clear is that he has a really good ear for comedy. And when he stopped practicing medicine, he put all his things in a storeroom in his house and just didn't think about them for years. And then if you haven't been practicing medicine for 5-7 years, something like that, you cease to become a registered physician. And he got this letter and thought, right, it's silly me keeping all my notes. So he went through them and threw most of them out, but found his diary. You're supposed to keep a reflective practice journal as you are training, which he did with his trademark comedy. And it's these diaries that he has turned into this book.
But I think it's his pace and his humour, which is what you'd probably call dark comedy or bittersweet comedy. Because behind the laughter, there's a very, very serious point he's making. And he reveals to us in a very comedic way. Most junior doctors are overworked. And he goes into great detail about that. An 18-hour day is quite normal. And the fact that your shift finishes at 6 means nothing. And you could be there till 10 or 11 o'clock in the evening. So he does explain to us very well what it's like to be a junior doctor. And we should now just pause for an excerpt from the audiobook.
Monday the 23rd of October 2006. Called to A&E to review a gentleman in his 70s. I check with the A&E officer that he realises he's bleeped gynaecology. Reviewing a man would be rather pushing my remit. It's complicated, apparently. It'll explain when I get down there. I meet patient NS, a Sikh gentleman who speaks no English at all. He's on holiday, visiting family, and has been unhelpfully accompanied to the hospital by a relative who also speaks no English. His history is therefore taken with the assistance of a telephone interpreter service. In this instance, a Punjabi translator's on the line, and the phone is passed back and forth. This particular interpreter may have rather fudged his CV. He seems to be able to speak only slightly more Punjabi than someone who can't speak any Punjabi whatsoever. The Stoic A&E staff have been making glacial progress using the interpreter and relay what they've established. The patient is bleeding from down below, has been doing so for the past week, and, crucially to my attendance, is a hermaphrodite. I tell the A&E officer that I sincerely doubt this elderly bearded man is part of the intersex community and ask him to speak to the interpreter. Can you ask if the patient has a womb? The phone gets passed back and the patient starts to repeat a word to us very loudly and angrily in Punjabi. The patient furiously unbuttons his shirt to reveal a portacath. A eureka moment. In unison, we all say, "Haemophiliac." I'll leave them to deal with his rectal bleed. Hermaphroditism is a very rare intersex disorder where the patient possesses both testicular and ovarian tissue. It's named after the Greek legend of Hermaphroditus, who was said to be both male and female. She was the son-daughter of Hermes and Aphrodite, who, it must be said, had a pretty lazy system for naming their children.
The thing about this book is that everyone's experienced the NHS, haven't they?
Yes.
Most people, I'm sure most of our listeners have. We've all got our stories. We've all got our point of identification. We've all had some great experiences with doctors and some not so good. So I think this is a real winner, and it's why it's become a bestseller.
I did like the beginning of the book when he said he chose to work in the maternity ward because it's the only place that you actually double your patients. And as compared to the geriatric ward. And, you know, there's lots of quips like that in the book that make you laugh, although sometimes you feel a little bit guilty about laughing.
You do. I think we've got some lovely quotes, haven't we? There's one that we picked from quite early on in the book, before he's actually specialised, that we could listen to now, just to show how great this guy is at writing comedy.
Tuesday, 31st of May, 2005. 3 nights ago, I admitted patient MJ, a homeless guy in his 50s, with acute pancreatitis. This was the third time we'd admitted him with acute pancreatitis since I started this job. We got him comfortable with pain relief and started him on IV fluids. He was sore and miserable. "At least you get a warm bed for a few nights," I said. "You joking," he replied. "I'll get bloody MRSA in here." It's come to something when the streets outside a hospital have a better reputation for cleanliness than the corridors within. I don't like to preach, but I'm a doctor, and not wanting him to die is kind of in the job description. So I reminded him he's in here because of alcohol. Even if I can't persuade him to stop drinking, which I can't, could I at least ask him to stay off it until we've got him out of hospital? That will really help. This time it'd be a real bonus if he wouldn't mind laying off the alcohol dispensers. He reared back like I'd just accused him of twincest, telling me that of course he'd never do that. "They've changed the recipe recently, now it tastes really bitter." He pulled me closer to whisper in my ear that in this hospital you're best off sucking on some of the sanitising wipes, and he gave me a conspiratorial tap on the arm as if to say, "That's one on me." Tonight he discharged himself home, but will doubtless be back with us in the coming weeks.
Literally on every page there's a funny story or a funny anecdote, or he has a play on words as well. It's not for someone who's a little bit shy of medical terms, and it's not for anybody who's a bit squeamish.
Although I would say he explains the medical terms pretty well. I will say that the language is a bit fast. It's not offensive.
There's a fair amount of swearing in it, and I think the swearing is part of his frustration of not always being able to do the job that he's employed to do, and I think it goes part and part with it. The dark humour, I think, it's justified in this case. I mean, there are various instances in the book where he compares notes with his colleagues, and they tend to sort of meet at the end of the day and discuss their cases and who has the most outrageous case. And there's one particular scene where he talks to a colleague about the most outrageous names he's heard babies been given.
Yes.
And there's one called Satan, particularly sticks in my mind, and another one called Lasagna. So it's a way of relieving the pressure, isn't it? Another thing that struck me, and I think we're just talking about the NHS, and as you've rightly said, everyone has experience of the NHS. Mm. It's very rare that you wouldn't have had experience. And it does give you this really, really specific insight into what it's like at the coal front.
Absolutely. And it has opened my eyes. I have certainly had sympathy with the junior doctors, but I realised I didn't have enough. It really, really made me think. I suppose I thought, I know it's hard, I know how long hours these people work, but in the fullness of time, they're going to be earning a very high salary. I was wrong. It really is. It's appalling. Their average wage, if they take all the hours they work rather than the ones ones they're kind of contracted to is less than minimum wage. And these people have invested 7 years of their life studying. Yeah. There's so much money studying.
Yes.
And it's so hard with degrees now, isn't it? You have to think about whether you're ever going to get the money back. And I'm not surprised so many people drop out.
Absolutely right. I felt the same way about it. I thought I'd understood what their position was. But I think this book should be compulsory for any health ministers.
That's what I like about it. But if something can entertain and make you think, then I think that's the perfect piece of art. And I think that's what Adam Kay has achieved here. And he's honest about that, particularly in the last couple of chapters of the book, that he sees himself as a bit of a vigilante here. So I agree. I think every health minister should read this book. And I hope that they reach some kind of compromise. Part of it is about working conditions. So there's a bit in the book about signing away their rights, basically, for the
European directive.
That's right.
Yes, absolutely right. And they, I think it's 35 hours a week that we're all supposed to work. And obviously they have to sign to say they're going to work more.
Yeah.
So immediately they're on the back foot. He does explain several times over in the book that you can't leave a patient. You can't say, my shift is finished and I can leave now. You can't, because you may be in the middle of an operation, you may be in the middle of a consultancy, you could be in the middle of something. You can't walk out. It's not an option for junior doctors. Again, a lot of time when the sickness happens, you have to cover your colleagues' shifts.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that means double shifting. And he, in quite a few incidents, he falls asleep in his car.
He wakes up Christmas morning. I'm late for work. Oh no, I actually didn't leave the car park.
Yes.
And at one point he gets food poisoning and phones in and they say, all right, find someone to cover you.
Yes, and the emphasis is on him to find someone to cover.
I know.
Yeah, it's very funny. And we should now just pause for an excerpt from the audiobook.
Wednesday, 27th of September, 2006. I'm off sick for the first time since qualifying. Work weren't exactly sympathetic. Oh, for God's sake, spat my registrar when I rang in. Can't you just come in for the morning? I explained I had caught bad food poisoning and was in some kind of gastrointestinal meltdown. Fine, he said, with a kind of weary, simmering, passive aggression I normally only get at home. But phone around and find someone who's on leave to cover you. Now, I'm pretty sure this isn't the protocol at Google or GlaxoSmithKline or even Ginsters. Is there a single other workplace where you'd conceivably be asked to arrange your own sickness cover? The North Korean army, maybe. I wonder what level of illness would stop it from being my responsibility. Broken pelvis? Lymphoma? Or just when I was intubated on ITU and denied the power of speech?
And here we have an excerpt from the book with Adam's views on birth plans.
Friday, 6th of February, 2009. The whole thing was doomed from the start. Having a birth plan always strikes me as akin to having a what-I-want-the-weather-to-be plan or a winning the lottery plan. Two centuries of obstetricians have found no way of predicting the course of a labour, but a certain denomination of floaty-dressed mother seems to think she can manage it easily. And needless to say, HJ's birth plan has gone right up the swanee. Hypnotherapy has given way to gas, and air has given way to an epidural. The midwife tells me the patient snapped at her husband to turn that BS off when he was fiddling with a volume on the whale grunts. She's been stuck at 5 centimetres dilatation for the best part of 6 hours, despite syntocinon. We've given it a couple more hours twice now. So I explain baby isn't going to come out vaginally, and I'm not prepared to wait until it inevitably becomes distressed and there's a huge emergency. We're going to need to perform a cesarean section. As expected, this doesn't go down particularly well. Come on, she says, there must be a third way. Well, I'm loath to court a formal complaint from a patient who wants their birth to be blog post perfect and has somehow been let down by nature. I've had a complaint in the past from a patient who I refused to allow to have candles burning while she laboured. I don't think it's such an unreasonable request, she wrote. About having naked flames right next to oxygen tanks? This patient's got strongly worded email written all over her. So I cover myself by asking the consultant to pop by and have a quick chat with her. Luckily, Mr. Cadogan is on duty. He's fatherly, charming and soothing, and he smells expensive, which has posh women flocking to the private ward he'd much rather be on. He soon has HJ consented for theatre. He even offers to do the section himself, to quiet mutterings of derision and amazement from the other staff. No one here can remember the last time he delivered a baby for free. Perhaps golf's been rained off.
Yeah, it's a great read. It's so funny, so enlightening. I think I got through it within a week. It was so hard to put down.
It was very, very easy to get through. Very readable, very listenable. Maybe we should do our three reasons for listening to this audiobook.
Okay, well, for me, the first one is that it's a really funny, engaging read. The second is that it really will make you think. And because of the way it makes you think about the NHS, it might change the way you behave in the future when you encounter the NHS. I think it's two reasons. It's a really funny book and it really does make you think.
It does. I'd agree with both of those points. It's very funny and serious at the same time. And it's quite a skill to do that.
Absolutely.
It's a real skill to be able to take a really, really dark moment in your life or several dark moments in his particular career and make them funny and look back and find the humour in it.
Yeah, without being offensive in some way.
Without being offensive, without offending anybody, and just step back from something you've been very heavily involved in and be able to take a light-hearted approach. But in doing that, revealing so much, it's very clever in that way. And you learn so much from the book. That's what I thought. There's so many medical terms I now understand, which I previously didn't.
Yes. So if we're ever in hospital and they speak in some of those funny medical codes, we'll know what they mean.
So, yes, it's definitely worth a listen. As I said before, not for maybe the squeamish or those who might be offended by a little bit of bad language, but it's worth it and it's totally justified.
TNF Soundings.
Okay, my name is Heather Wastey and I'm a poet and a songwriter and I was born in Cradley Heath. Anybody know Cradley Heath?
Yes.
Oh, Boston.
I used to the Speedway years ago.
Okay, right. I lived the other side of the bonk to the Speedway.
Oh, right.
We lived in Hollybush Street. I lived with my mum and dad in Hollybush Street and my dad and his brother ran a cooperage. Does anybody know what a cooperage is?
Beer or drink, tell me, you got it.
It's, in a way, it's to do with beer, because barrels...
But
we did what's called dry coopering. So it's for barrels for transporting heavy goods. Because obviously barrels, you can roll. Not a packing case, you've got to be able to pick it up. But a barrel, you can roll. So until packing cases came in, cooperage was quite a thriving industry. And we used to live, because it was a family firm, it had been in the family for over 100 years at that time, and we lived on the premises. I've got two brothers. When my youngest brother was just a few years old, we had to move because they were planning to demolish the street. So the family moved up to Rowley Regis, and the company moved to Portisfield Estate, which is the other end of Cradley Heath. And I will say at this stage that I'm doing the presentation in two halves. And after the first half, I'll stop and ask if you've got any questions. Because you might have. Well, you might not. It doesn't matter. So in the late 1960s, we had to move. About 25 years later, I started to write down memories of Hollybush Street because I missed it. I wasn't able to go back there. So I started to write poems and songs about it. And then another 30 years on, starting to build up a picture of my age, I published a collection of all the pieces in a book which is called One Mid, One Growed, and I've got a copy with me. I'm going to describe the front cover. On the front cover there's a black and white photo of me aged about five and I'm wearing what I called a sticky outy white dress. It was one of those, it was hard net and I really wanted a sticky outy dress. So it's a sticky outy white dress, white gloves, white shoes and socks. It was a bridesmaid's dress for my auntie. And I also wore it for the Sunday school anniversary. And I'm standing proudly in the yard of our house in front of a brick wall and a concrete flower border. The flowers aren't concrete, but the border was. and you can also just about see the steps that go up into the cooperage where all the coopers worked. And I used to go in there sometimes and talk to the coopers. I even used to play there when they'd gone home, which is a bit dangerous, but I never injured myself. The background photo on the cover shows the front of our house. So we were number 37, and next door was the cooperage office and yard, number 38. And I want to try and give you an idea of what it was like growing up in Hollybush Street in the 1960s, and it might remind you of some of your memories of what it was like in your street when you were growing up. And I'm going to start by doing the first poem that I wrote, which was must have been in the 1990s. And it's named after our address, 37 Hollybush Street. 37 Hollybush Street, a few doors up from the Mission. Lying in bed on a Sunday morning, trying hard not to listen to the slowest singing in Cradley Heath, a rousing hypnotic dirge. May all God's notes be merged as one, slide heavenward and converge. And when we've emptied out our lungs and Lord can sing no more, we'll quench our lasting thirst for thee in the holly bush next door. 37 Hollybush Street, a few doors down from Dingley's, source of kali and sherbet dabs and chocolate drops sold singly. And late in the darkness goes Uncle George, who brought in the coal at New Year. As he rolls down the road with his darling Gladys, piercing the closing time air, comes, "Good night, Gladys," and "Good night, George," all down the street and beyond, echoing through the silent years, till front doors bang shut and are gone. 37 Hollywood Street, the heart of a microcosm, from the boy who dribbled and never grew old to the woman who flaunted her bosom. And one day they shovelled us into a heap and threw all the pavements away, stopping just short of the pub and the Mission and leaving we nowhere to play. Oh, it's a sad poem.
Thank you to all our volunteers who've read the Sandwell Express and Star articles this week. Mia, Jan, Rachel, Linda, Alison and Trevor. Thanks to Rosie for doing the quiz this week. Thanks to Cyrita for uploading everything to the website. And thank you to Sue for picking all the articles that people have read. Also, of course, a big thank you to Ray, Tony and Gavin for all of the work that they do behind the scenes, putting it all together and sending it out to you. So I'd like to welcome all our new listeners. We've been out taking some talking news players to new people. I hope you've enjoyed this edition. And I hope everyone's survived this extreme heat that we've had over the last few days. I know some people love it and some people hate it. I'm amongst the haters, I'm afraid, but I'm sure we'll all be complaining about the rain next week. Well, have a lovely week, everyone.
And Pam leaves me just to say that I hope you've enjoyed this rather crowded edition. I hope you also managed to get through the warm weather without much ill effect. Certainly challenged me. That's it for now then. Do get the USB pen drives back to as soon as you can. But for now, bye-bye from me, Ray, and all the team until we meet you again in June.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.